Oh, good morning, church. I'm on. Oh, man, it is what a beautiful time of praise and worship and our time around the table. I always relish that time we have to gather and take the Lord's Supper together, and appreciated Zach's thoughts both regarding the table and the time of offering. Thought those were really, really poignant. So we are now officially in our new year. Happy 2020. When I was a kid, did 2020 just sound futuristic to anybody else? 2020. I mean, that's like, that sounded so far away from me. I spent a good portion of my last week and just thinking back to my childhood and about what I thought the future would be like and how much the world has changed and in ways that are personal, you know, the way that I have a family of my own now with kids and a wife, and the way that the world has changed in larger ways, like the way technology has changed our world, or transportation, and all these things. It's just hard to fathom how much has happened since then. There's been so many surprises along the way. Did anybody else besides me ever collect baseball cards? Anybody else? Well, I have a whole box here of baseball cards. These are mostly from 1990, some from 1991. But I want to do something really quick. I got some guys earlier to sort of volunteer, sort of got drafted to doing this. Grayson had the misfortune of playing a baseball game in front of me on his phone, and so that got him drafted. Then Miles was back there, Owen and Maddox. You guys come up here and just get handfuls of baseball cards and just start passing them out. And I'll tell you what, you can keep whatever's left over. That's going to be my gift to you, my payment. I mean, these cards are 30 years old. They could be worth a lot of money. They're not, but they could be. Just go pass those out to make sure everybody gets some. There you go. And here's some for you. Just go give all those away that you want. And here's some more. And I have more. If you don't get 10 or 20 or 50, just let me know. I have plenty more. I used to have a lot more baseball cards, but I loved collecting baseball cards. I mean, I just thought it was so much fun. And I would get my cards and I would trade cards with my brother and our neighbors and any kids that I found were gullible enough to trade with me. And then I would go out and I would buy the latest copy of, I don't know if you're in the know, but it was Beckett, which was a buying guide. And it came out every month or so, and it would have in it listed all the prices of the mainstream baseball cards from companies like Topps and Fleer and Donruss. And eventually you get some other companies that kind of join in, Upper Deck and Stadium Club, and some other companies started making baseball cards, but all of these cards would be listed, and so I would look up, you know, my card number. Every card has a number on it, and then you go through the guide and find out, oh, this card is worth a quarter, or this card is worth, you know, $1 or $5, and some really expensive, and then I would arrange my cards accordingly, and I would arrange them by their value, or I would arrange them according to teams. You know, I looped all the teams together. Sometimes I would arrange them according to my favorites. You know, I had my favorite players. I spent hours and dollars, and there's no telling how much time and money that I spent on baseball cards as a kid. I would take birthday money and Christmas money and lawn mowing money, and I would go to the card store and buy favorite cards, or if I just didn't have time or couldn't get to the card store, I'd just go to the grocery store and buy packs of cards. And in my mind, just to be fair, in my mind, I was not spending money. I was investing money because I saw how much those cards had gone up in value over the previous 30 years or so, right? I mean, if you were a kid, if you were like my dad, if he had kept the cards he had from when he was a kid and taken good care of them, those were worth some serious money. In fact, those are still worth some serious money. So I thought, oh, I am just ahead of the game here. I know they're going to be worth money, so I bought a lot, and I'm just going to save them. And my favorite player, far and away, without question, was Roger Clemens. So my largest two investments were these cards. Now, these two are Roger Clemens rookie cards. Specifically, that's his Fleer, and that's his Topps rookie card. And I never had the money to buy his Donruss rookie card. That was worth a lot of money at the time. So I spent a good amount of cards and money to acquire these two, my prized possessions, Roger Clemens rookie cards. And eventually, I spent $20 more, or $10 on each of them, to have Roger Clemens autograph these when he was at a baseball card show in Dallas, Texas. My neighbor was going, and I sent him with a $20 bill and my two cards, and he stood in line and got them autographed. I would love to show you those, but I can't because we have moved 9 times, and I do not know where my Roger Clemens baseball cards are. All of them. I had like 140 different Roger Clemens cards. That's just, I was a little bit of a fanatic. And I had all those. Anyway, there was a lot of time and a lot of money in it, but I just knew that these were going to keep increasing in value, and I felt like I had made a good trade. Now, you may or may not have collected baseball cards or football cards or basketball cards or superhero cards or Pokemon or Garbage Pail Kids. I don't know what it is you collected. But as adults, we tend to start doing something similar. We enjoy the thrill of a good trade. And so in adult world, some of you may trade cars because it's so much fun to get a good deal on a car. Or you may enjoy trading property if you have the means to do that and find a great piece of property you think is going to be worth something or you can do something with. And so you'll trade for property. I have an uncle who was really into trading horses. He had an eye for horse flesh, and he could spot which horses were going to pan out and which horses weren't, and he would buy, sell, and trade horses. And then he loved the thrill of it. And then when he couldn't do horses anymore, he would just do junk cars. And at any time in his life, he might have 8 cars. And he would have like full-size conversion vans. And I'm like, you are single, and you do not travel. What are you doing with this? But he just loved the trade, right? But on the flip side, there's the terrible feeling that comes with the realization that you have made a bad trade. I realized that in trading for some of my prize cards, I traded away a Ken Griffey rookie card, which went up considerably in value. Somebody recognizes. And especially when the stakes are high, you know, you trade cars for what you think is a great deal, and you find out the car is a lemon, or you find out that the property, you know, doesn't have good drainage, or you realize that the horse is sick. You know, all these things can happen. Well, in Mark's gospel, we've come to one of the most symbolic of all the stories in his gospel. It's the story of Jesus standing before Pilate, awaiting his judgment, and the terrible trade, the terrible exchange that takes place there instead. It comes from Mark chapter 15. We're going to begin reading at verse 6. And we read, "Now it was the custom at the festival," and remember, this is the festival of the Passover, "to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists, or the rebels, right, who had committed murder in the uprising. Now, the crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. 'Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?' asked Pilate, knowing it was out of jealousy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. 'Who would you rather I release?' Pilate asked. 'Jesus or Barabbas?' 'Jesus, who has gone throughout the land, teaching people, feeding the hungry, healing the sick, raising the dead, or this guy who's a murderer? Who would you rather have in your community?' On the surface to us, it doesn't sound like much of a trade. Like, who would choose Barabbas? Why would you choose Barabbas? That doesn't make any sense. So it's difficult for us to imagine why in the world the crowd would choose Barabbas, even with the chief priest spurring them on. But it might help if we take a little bit of a closer look at this character Barabbas. We don't know a lot about Barabbas, to be fair. This is the only time in any of the Gospels that he's mentioned is this specific scenario. Boy, that was not easy. So we don't know a lot about his history. We're told he was a part of an uprising. We don't even know which uprising it was, though there were several that took place in early first century Palestine. So we don't know which rebellion he was a part of, but these uprisings against the Romans were not all that uncommon. Some of these uprisings, they just wanted to fight the Romans. We're going to get together a ragtag band of patriots, and we are going to fight off the Roman overlords, right? We're going to do that. So some of that was what happened. It doesn't seem to be that was the case with Barabbas' particular group. He was a part of the second kind of rebels, and these were disenfranchised peasants. They were people who either owned or had lost their family land, more likely by this point, and were just working hand to mouth, just to try to make like a day laborer, and they weren't even making ends meet then. And so these poor people were being squeezed out of the economy by the rich and the powerful. And the Romans were sort of facilitating that. And so this group began being bandits. And they would waylay the rich and steal from the wealthy and take stuff from the powerful. And this group was more like a first century Robin Hood. And so the common people, when they saw Barabbas, they didn't think murderer. They saw this person understands the hatred we have for the Romans and the rich and the powerful the way we do. They understand what we are going through and how bad we're being treated and how these people are profiting off of our lives. Like we're literally giving our lives so the rich can get richer. And so the common people tended to really side with these sort of rebels. They didn't hate the murderer. They were glad someone was standing up for them. So it isn't hard to see whatever type of rebel Barabbas was a part of, and he seems to be he was more in the Robin Hood type, but why he might be supported by the crowd. In fact, Jesus and Barabbas, if you stop and think about it, were in some ways kind of similar. Let's start with their names, okay? Their names are similar. In Matthew's gospel, Barabbas is not just called Barabbas, he's called Jesus Barabbas. Now that doesn't happen in Mark, Luke, or John, and it only happens in a few of the ancient copies that we have of Matthew, particularly one particular strain out of Caesarea, that he was called Jesus Barabbas. And so it's not highly attested, but it very well could have been. You certainly wouldn't want, if you were early Christians and you were copying the New Testament, you wouldn't want to associate the name Jesus with Barabbas. So it very well may be the case. But beyond that, even if that's whether that's true or not, is not a big argument. The bigger deal is Barabbas' name, Barabbas. Barabbas, Bar, Abbas, is an Aramaic name, made of two words. Bar, son of Abbas, the father. The son of the father. And we're reminded of Jesus' prayer just the previous chapter when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane and Jesus prays, Abba, Father. More than their names were similar, though, both saw the sorry state of the world, right? And they didn't just see what was broken. They both wanted to do something about it, and they both tried to do something about it. They were both trying to change their world. They both wanted to undermine the current state of affairs. And so we might say that they were both doing this from outside positions. Neither of them were in positions of power. It wasn't like Barabbas was a governor and Jesus was a king, right? These are outsiders. These are nobodies. These are peasants. These are working class, blue collar nobodies with no power and no influence, no money. And they were the ones who were doing it. So they were both subversives. They were both revolutionaries who were working actively to change their world. They had that in common too. But here's the major difference between Jesus and Barabbas. And that was just their methods. Like how they went about changing their world. Barabbas, saw the injustice and the oppression. He felt it. It was a weight on his chest. And his answer was violent revolution. Even if it requires murder, the way that we get of violence, the way that we get rid of oppression is to kill. And that's kind of every military in the world ever's answer, right? If we could just kill the violent people, the world would be peaceful. That's kind of been our answer. Not just us, but everybody else too. Jesus, on the other hand, came to establish a new kingdom altogether. One that was based on repentance and forgiveness. Both Jesus and Barabbas had tons of enemies. The difference was that Barabbas sought to kill his enemies. Jesus sought to love his enemies sacrificially. There's the big difference between Jesus and Barabbas. They both saw the broken state of the world. They both wanted to change it. They were both willing to put their lives on the line to change it. But Barabbas wanted to kill his enemies. Jesus wanted to love them sacrificially. And frankly, it is a lot easier to hate and kill your enemies than it is to love them. It's just a lot easier. It comes more naturally. At least it comes more naturally to me. So the crowd, with the help and the stirring up by the chief priests, cry for the release of Barabbas because, frankly, that's who they identified with. They would much rather see Barabbas succeed. And so Barabbas walked free. In a sense, Barabbas was the very first beneficiary of Jesus' prophetic mission. And just a few chapters previous, Jesus said, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Barabbas, a rebel and a part of a group that had committed murder, walked free because Jesus willingly laid down his own life on his behalf, on Barabbas' behalf. Jesus just stood there, offered no defense. He didn't have any clever teachings, no astounding miracles. By the way, if I were Jesus and I were in that position and you were trying to convict me of something that I didn't do, that's exactly what I would have been doing. I've been like, "You don't think I'm really the Son of God? Everybody's blind." Right? "You don't think I'm the Son of God? All right, everybody check your pockets. You've got pockets full of bread now." That would have been pretty cool. Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't say, "I know exactly what you're thinking. This is what you're thinking." And nail Pilate, he could have done that. He doesn't tell the crowd what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, right? He could have done that. What sort of man does that? Jesus does nothing to prove that he's the true king, at least not at this point. What sort of man does this for a murderer whom he's never met? And maybe we can imagine, and I try to do this, I try to imagine like laying down my life for other people. Especially this week, I was really trying to think, what would that be like to lay down my life for someone else, to give my life as a ransom to save someone else? And I can imagine pretty easily doing that for my kids. I can imagine doing it for my wife or my parents, sometimes even my brother. Maybe you can imagine doing it for your really good friends. But to lay down your life for the many. Not just the thief and the murderer, Barabbas, but the followers who have abandoned you at this point. The crowd who is crying for your conviction. The chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees who have plotted to have you killed. The Gentile or Roman governor who refuses to stand up for you and defend you even though he knows you're innocent. The soldiers who seize you and mock you and beat you without mercy. In fact, they think it's a sport. What sort of terrible, terrible trait is this? And yet it is one that Jesus walks into knowingly and willingly. And we still don't even know like what Jesus' fate is. We know Barabbas gets released, so we know Jesus
doesn't. But what's Pilate going to do with him? Pilate doesn't seem to know. Pilate doesn't walk into this with a grand plan, thinking this is what I'm going to do with Jesus. Pilate doesn't know what he's going to do with him either. So he turns to the crowd. And I know, look, you are all smart people, and most of you have read the Bible. And even if you haven't read this particular passage, you've heard it preached. And even if you haven't heard this passage preached, you've heard the story, right? Everybody knows how this story ends. But just for a second, just for a second, I want us to put ourselves into the shoes of like an unbeliever who doesn't know the story. Those who have just like gotten all they know is what they've been told so far in Mark's story. And you know Jesus is a great teacher, and that he takes people under his wing. He tries to tutor them and mentor them. We know Jesus is a miracle worker, and that he's healed the sick and made the lame walk again and caused the blind to see and then caused the dead to be raised. And he's gone around and he's fed, you know, thousands of hungry people. And he's take pity on the people who are outside the system. He's reached out to people that everyone else rejects and neglects. And that's the person who speaks out on behalf of those who are being oppressed. And that's all you know about Jesus, is that's all he's done. And in their minds, they have to be rooting for Jesus to like find a way out. And in every movie or story you read, this is the point where you're like, oh no, the hero's tied up and the bad guy's about to win. What's going to happen? And in our minds, we know the hero's about to escape, right? The bad guy's going to make a long speech, or he's going to walk away, and somehow the good guy gets free and everything works out. So they have to be hoping that at this point, you know, God is going to step in and deliver him, or that Pilate would change his mind, or that the crowd would sort of come to their senses. Something, anything, to see Jesus set free, anything other than what happens when Pilate turns to the crowd and says, What shall I do then with the one you call the King of the Jews? Pilate asked them, crucify him, they shouted back. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him! Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged, and he did. He handed him over to be crucified. I mean, this is shocking. This is, by the way, the first time anywhere in Mark's gospel that we've seen this really ugly word, crucified. The first time. And by the way, this was the first, the oldest gospel. And so if you are not a believer and you're living back in this day and you're just coming across this story or you're hearing it recited and you come across this word and you think, this is the person they're following, they're shouting, crucify? How could this be? Crucifixion was the fate reserved for the worst of criminals. Those who the state wanted to make an example out of. Not just that they wanted them dead, because there's lots of ways to kill people. All right? Some of which are a lot more humane than others. But these are the ones that the state wanted to make an example out of. We don't just want to kill them. We want you to watch them die. And we don't just want you to watch them die. We want you to watch them die in a really humiliating, painful, long, and suffering way. And this fact is backed up by the fact that Jesus is crucified between two bandits. By the way, most likely people who were in Barabbas' party. They were a part of the same insurrection Barabbas was. And in all likelihood, you get a queue of criminals, right? These are all the convicted, guilty people. They come up to the front of the queue, and they're called the same names. Probably a part of the same rebellion, the same uprising. Now we see clearly this dual role of Jesus, the defining characteristics of a Messiah, that he is both the victorious king and the suffering servant. That's what Mark wants us to see, that yes, Jesus is the victorious king, but he's also the suffering servant. Now, for Mark's earliest readers, the ones to whom he was writing who were already Christians, this dual theme would have been particularly comforting. Because guess what? They were suffering too. They were going through trials and they were being persecuted. These Gentile Christians to which Mark wrote were going through persecutions, and it felt like they were losing too. Because people were dying, people were in prison, and it didn't seem like that God was really doing anything about it. But to see here that even in suffering, there's triumph. That's the great hope of the kingdom of God. That, by the way, is ultimately what you traded for. That's what we traded for when we gave our lives to God. The promise that He would be with us in suffering. And that, not just that He would be with us in the suffering, but that He would go through it with us and bring us out on the other side in glory. That's the trade that you've made. For a long time, I was confused. I thought the trade that I had made was that I would give my life to God and God would make sure everything was all right. And so that's really disappointing when your Christian life does not go smoothly. Right? When you think God's just going to make everything easy. That you get sick, God makes you well. That you pray for someone who's hurting and they miraculously are stop hurting, or they don't die, or that you get in financial trouble and you pray and God just makes the financial troubles go away, or your relationship gets in trouble and you talk to God about it and it's just always all better. And that was what I thought I had signed up for. But that's not the trade we made. This is the trade that we made. We traded for victory in suffering. We traded for both a servant and a king. And when we start laying down our lives the way Jesus did, you can bet there will be suffering. But it will not be suffering that is pointless. It will not be suffering that has no cause or no effect. It will not be suffering outside the plan of God for no reason. It will be suffering that glorifies God the way Jesus' suffering glorifies God, and that we will emerge on the other side victorious. That's a good trade. A good trade. And if this morning you are ready to give your lives to God, to make this trade, to walk with Jesus, difficult though it may be, then He is ready and willing to love you and welcome you and receive you. Commit your life to Him today. Don't wait any longer. Won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?